I basically, what I hope to do in this talk is get through the general gallery of the general prologue, meet the cast of characters. I'll be focusing on some of them in particular, more by way of giving an indication of how Chaucer the poet is operating. Others we will come back to when we look at their tales, and we'll connect what we find in the prologue with the tale that they actually tell. We have a fairly large group traveling on this pilgrimage. These are not groups of old friends who have gathered together. These are strangers. These are strangers who have come together for the point of going on the pilgrimage and for various motives. And if we have basically, and I'm going to continue calling it the two ways or the two routes, if you will, in the world, the one of a pilgrimage to the celestial city, to the great cathedral, to the place of penance and repentance and hopefully judgment of a beneficial kind. There are others who are there for different reasons. So we've got a vast array. But Chaucer does something else as well. In presenting this group of characters, he is giving us a cross-section of medieval life. The idea in the Middle Ages, and this was fairly common, was that there were basically three estates, three groups of people, if you will. There were the knights, there was the clergy, and there were the commoners. Or, I think it's easier to remember it this way. There are those whose job was to fight, there were those whose job was to pray, and there were those whose job was to work in the workaday world. And in that sense, you have three different groups, when combined together, form the fullness of the society. Each group with a different specific mission, each operating, or each group should be operating in a different sphere, which means there was not a great deal of interaction. They would maintain each would maintain its own sphere, so that for them to gather together on this pilgrimage is unique. It springs to mind that kind of clear definition is medieval at root. We now have everybody trying to do everybody else's job. As a result, nobody can do anything. And if we look specifically at those three groups, we don't have knights anymore. There's nobody who will fight because our so-called warriors, most of whom are female, believe in peace. We've got a clergy that refuses to pray. They're out doing, well, we know what, with certain honored exceptions, of course. I'm speaking in the world. And we have those who work who have turned over their work to machines and they have nothing to do other than shuffle papers. I mean, it's, again, hats off to the Middle Ages that had definition and clarity. So what we have is all three groups are presented in the prologue. We meet all three, but they are going to the same place. I was privileged a number of summers to lecture in Italy at the request of Dr. John Rao, a dear friend and a great historian. And I remember a series of lectures he gave on the early Middle Ages and the vision of what he called the Great Pilgrimage to God, that whatever your role in society was, there was this idea that everyone banded together and as part of a unified whole was on this glorious and great pilgrimage to God. That idea is in Chaucer. It's here in the Canterbury Tales. So you have the three estates, those who fight, those who pray, and those who work, coming together on that pilgrimage. And we have an embodiment of a classic medieval idea in 29 Pilgrims and in this literary work. Now what we find is they are presented in groups. And Chaucer is with them. He mentions himself. They're at the Tabard Inn, ready to head out on the pilgrimage. They spend a night there. Of sondry folk, by aventure fallen fellowship, and pilgrims were thy all. It just happens that they're all together there, and they're all going to ride towards Canterbury. And our poet, our pilgrim, begins speaking to them individually. And he says, in order that, since he has the time here before they begin, he will tell us, ere that I further in this tala passa, before I go further in my story, may thinketh it according to resume to tell you of all the condition of each of them, so as it same it may, and which they were in, and of what degree, and ache in what array that they were in a, and at a connect that will he first begin a. I'll tell you about all of them, and what I'm going to tell you, and he makes it very clear, I'll tell you the condition of them, at least as it seemed to me, what they were, to what degree, what their social rank was, and what they were wearing. And this occurs with every one of the pilgrims. He sort of gives us a quick impression of them and then elaborates at what they're wearing. It is magnificent for the medieval historians. This prologue gives a sense of how they all dressed back then, and this is one of their real sources for it. But what Chaucer the poet is doing in having Chaucer the pilgrim devote so much of the prologue to what they're wearing is our pilgrim, Chaucer, as he begins, is obsessed with externals. Social rank and what they look like. And we will get quick character sketches, but the character sketches we're going to get in the prologue, for the most part, are very like if you go to a county fair, there will be an illustrator there who's good at doing caricature. You pay him $10, he'll draw your caricature. And sort of like, wow, this is good. There I am, look what I look like. And of course, what they are incapable of doing is showing the inside. They don't know you, they're just there, the pen can do a quick sketch. That's what Chaucer the Pilgrim is giving us in his quick sketch at the beginning. And what we have as Chaucer the Pilgrim begins this pilgrimage is a man who doesn't know much, can only see externals. What he has to learn on the pilgrimage, one of the things he must learn, is to see beyond exteriors and understand that what's happening inside in the soul is very different from what he's seeing on the outside. Okay? The great moment in Macbeth, King Duncan learns that one of his lords has been traitorous, and he can't believe it. This man seems so loyal, seems so good, and he says there is no art to find the mind's construction in the face. You cannot tell by externals what's going on inside. Enter Macbeth. It's a wonderful moment in the first act of the play. Well, Chaucer the Pilgrim at this point can get a sense of externals, but with his quick character sketches, he can't give us what's inside. However, he does have a sense of degree, and he begins with the person of highest standing. And that's the knight, the knicht. I love it in Middle English. All those consonants get pronounced, the knicht. And he is the person of highest standing because he is, if you will, the sword of the church militant. He is out there fighting on behalf of the work of God in the world. A knicht there was, and that a worthy man. That from the tema that he first began to reading out, he loved chivalria, truth and honor, freedom and courtesia. We get the praise immediately. Chaucer the Pilgrim does know a great man when he sees him. The knight's a great, this is a good man. And he goes on to tell us, he has ridden forth in every war, every battle that his lord has called him to. He's never said no. And of course, what we're getting is that the knight who would do his lord's work in terms of the society, clearly again, this is a knight who is ridden out and fought on behalf of his lord in the spiritual realm as well. We've got those two realms as well, the earthly and the spiritual. Full worthy was he in his lord aswera, and thereto had he ridden, no man fairer. Nobody went further. Nobody went further to fight those battles, as well in Christendom as in heathenessa, and ever honored for his worthinessa. Second time the word has appeared, worthy, worthy. That's being made very clear to us. Then we get a list of the battles he's fought in. Again, one could go through. This knicht has been on most of the major crusades of the time. He has fought in most of the major battles. He has been there, done that. And he has proven himself in action. He is a man of action, and he has fought the good fight. And though that he were worthy, third time, there may be another one in there, it just keeps repeating it, he was wis, he was wise. Okay, he's not just a good fighter, but he's a man of wisdom. And of his port as meka as is a maida. Externally, he was as meek and humble as a young girl. So he may be a great fighter and a worthy knight. He's also a wise man and a humble man. We are getting an idealized portrait of what a good knight should be. It's a quick sketch. Chaucer, even though he's only seeing externals, knows this is a good man, okay? He was a very perfect gentle knight, okay? And he had a really good horse that isn't overly decorated. But one reason we find out is he's just come back from one of those battles and he's headed right off on the pilgrimage. It's glorious. Now, his son is with him. His son is with him. A squire. I'm going to hold off on that because this becomes very important when we look at the knight's tale, okay? But just to set it in your mind, the next one we hear of is the son of this knight who's with his father but has spent his time doing other things and has a different orientation. I will come back to that this afternoon. And then there's a yeoman we hear about, the one who is there to help with the weapons. Just, you know, again, in one sense, he is part of that fighting class because without the yeoman there, the knight couldn't be properly prepared to do battle. We meet the three of them. So we begin with those who fight. We move into the second category. We begin with those who pray, and we first meet the prioress. This is it's a classic sketch because Chaucer the pilgrim is telling us more than he knows. We're finding a lot about this woman without the pilgrim being aware of what he's telling us, okay? For those of you who are, do you know where, are you following this in the book? Do you need page numbers or, as long as you're keeping up, I'm doing them right in order. I'm basically just doing them right in order. There was also a nonna, a prioressa, that of her smiling was full simple and coy. Her greatest oath was but by Saint Aloy. And she was clepid Madame Eglantine, full well she song the servisa divina, intuned in her nose, full semely. You get it instantly, don't you? Instantly. She's practiced her singing. She knows to sing through her nose. We know what it must sound like. Notice as well, she is very simple and coy in her smiling. There's a coy, a prioress who's coy. You know, again, you say, what's the word doing there? What does he mean? He's giving us more than we expect. It originally meant quiet, but it means quiet in a sort of deliberate, restrained way, okay? And French she spake, full fair and fettishly, after the school of Stratford atta Bowie. She studied her French, for French of Paris was to hear on Canoa. She's got as much French as she can that's appropriate. This is a lady who's learned how to sing. She's learned her French. She's very aware of how she smiles, okay? She let no morsel from... At Meta well he taught was she with all. When she sits down to eat, she has perfect table manners. She let no morsel from her lippes fall. Ne wette her fingers in her sauce a deba. There may be a great sauce with that meat, but she's not going to stick her fingers in. We have a genteel lady who's aware of her position and very aware of how the world is viewing her. Very aware of those externals. We are going to find out, and I'm going to have to, unfortunately, skip very quickly over the prioress's tale. She is a devout woman. This is gentle satire. This is a woman with some failings who wants to be social and courteous and aware of all that social refinement. well, I, let me, I, there's some wonderful things here. Let me keep going. Well could she carry a morsel and well caper that no drop and a fill upon her breast. In courtesy she was set full mucho her lest. Her over lip a wiped she so cleana that in her copa there was no fair thing sana of grace when she drunk and had her draught. She could take greasy meat and it would never, she used that lip so well she'd catch the grease before it dropped onto her, okay? And when she took something to drink, she was always very careful so that nothing would spill out. Table manners essential. This is part of the womanliness, but notice what's being emphasized about her. This is a prioress, okay? And secretly she was of great disport and full pleasant and amiable of port and pined her to contrafit chair of court and to bane estatic of manner and to ben hold and dign of reverence. She liked to be like the courtly ladies. Okay? And for to spaken of her conscience, she was so charitable and so pitous, she walled a weeper if that she saw a moose caught in a trapper. If it were dead or bleda, we have a refined conscience. We have a type that's common out there now. The mouse caught in a trap makes her weep. And if that mouse is bleeding, she weeps even more. Of smaller hundes had a she that she fed her with roasted flesh or milk and wastel bread. But sore wept she if one of them were dead. Or if men smote it with a year de smerta, and always conscience and tendre herta. She keeps little doggies and she feeds them very well. And if one of her little doggies dies, she weeps. Or if someone hates one of her yapping little mutts and kicks it or hits it with the sword, she's just overcome with grief, okay? It's beautiful. Today she'd be one of those ladies that would be working for animals' rights, okay? Now, she's still a prioress, and as I said, we're going to discover from her tale, she has a devout faith. We've got a complicated human character. We have a real human being. We have a woman of the faith, but a woman who is attracted to the world in a way, and especially attracted to society and the social graces, and who has a sentimental heart. The little mousies and the little doggies, and she loves them. She weeps over them. They're still around everywhere. Okay, you may know some. We get a little more. The last thing we learn of her, right at the end of the little sketch, a small corella boot her arm. She bar a pair of beads, gauded all with grain. She's carrying her beads with her, but they're very nicely done. They're quite expensive and rather fancy. And thereon hang a brooch of gold full sheena, on which there was writ a crown a day, and after a mor vincit omnia. Okay, love conquers all. Well, the question is, divine love? Sentimental love? What kind of love? Well, it's gentle. She has a nun with her, okay, a chaplain and three priests. They're all going together. It's a little group going there, all from obviously the area where her prior is. Now, the reason it's gentle is here comes the monk. A monk there was, a fair for the maestre, we've been through this already, okay, who loved hunting, a manly man. He could have been an abbot. He keeps many horses in his stable. When he goes out, you know he's going out hunting, you can hear him, okay. He does not believe that old text that monks should stay in the monastery. Okay? This ilka monk let olda thingas passa and held after the newer world the spasa. That's what monks used to do in the old days, but he is a new up-to-date monk and he's not going to be bound by the monastery. He's out in the world because that's where his work is. Unfortunately, his work is hunting. He hath not of that text a pulled hen that saith that hunters be not holy men. Well, hunters can certainly be holy men, but what about a monk who's not in prayer but out hunting? We've got a little switcheroo there. Now that a monk, when he is wretchedless, is likened till a fish that is waterless. A monk out of the monastery is like a fish out of water. He has no regard for that text. No. This is to sign a monk out of his cloistra, but silke text held he not worth an oystra. Pah. That's what they say. But and Isida, his opinion was God. Chaucer the pilgrim agrees with him. Chaucer the pilgrim understands. What shall he study and make himself and woad mad? Why should he sit at the monastery and study until he goes crazy? Never gang outside at all. Upon a balk in cloistra, alway to pora, or swinken with his hondas in labora as Austin bit? Well, now, St. Augustine said the monk should be in the monastery and study and pray and work hard and labor on the monastery. Well, that's what St. Augustine, but why? How shall the world be served? Let Austin have his swink to him reserved. Well, that's one man's opinion. The world needs good manly men out there. We need to see these monks. Get them out! Get them out of their, get them out of their cloisters. Don't keep them locked up. The world needs to have these religious people walking among them, and put on his hunting clothes and give him a good horse, and that's just great. Have we heard this before? Oh, you know, it all comes round again, folks. It all keeps coming round again. There's nothing new under the sun. But please notice, Chaucer the Pilgrim is swallowing it whole. Yeah. Yeah, makes sense to me. And of course, what we have is a severe defect in judgment. Severe defect in judgment on both the part of the monk and on the part of Chaucer the Pilgrim, but clearly not on the part of Chaucer the Poet, who's creating these little sketches, again, to tell us much more indirectly than he is directly. But things go downhill quickly. Notice the next. A frere there was, a friar, a wantoon and a Maria, a wanton and a merry man, a limitur, a full solemniman, in all of the orders for is none that can so much of dalliance and fair langage. Ooh, can he speak smoothly? Ooh, is he, you know, he's absolutely on top of everything. And he's very social. He's very social. He had a mod for many a mariage of younger woman at his own cost. What a great man. There are all these young women that he's providing the dowry for to see that they're able to get married. Chaucer the pilgrim says, isn't it? That's so kind of him. And we're going, please, please. Unto his order, he was a noble post. He's a model for his order. Notice what we're getting here is clear criticism of church figures veiled so that the poet can do it and not seem to be openly critical. He is assuming the pose of the pilgrim so that in his stupidity he can say, you know, look at this fine man. What a fine friar, a model for his order. And look at all this money he gives to all these young women so they can get married. And he gives it out of his own pocket. What a guy. And you know the original readers of the poem are going, we know that guy. Yeah, I know. It is veiled criticism, but clear criticism, okay? And he goes on. Look closely at the description of the friar. He is, he's a piece of work. He's a piece of work. And then we meet the merchant, okay? Now we're meeting some of the working folks. We're meeting some of the working folks. I'm skipping over the merchant, going to the clerk, okay? The student at Oxford. This is one of the good fellows. His work is to study. A clerk there was of Oxenford also that unto logic had a long ago. As lane was his horse as is a raca, and he nas not richt fat e undertaka, but loked hallway and there to soberly. He's got a skinny horse. He himself is nearly that skinny. And he obviously looks almost hollow and very sober. He is a real student. He's spent his time inside studying and has no money. Full threadbare was his overest of court to pee, for he had a getten him yet no benefice. Now was so worldly for to have office. He has not yet become part of the system and got himself a good benefice where he can make money and become part of that big church mechanism. Nor is he so worldly to go out into the world and by heading out there get himself a good position. He's studying, and in study there's no money. We have a figure who's doing what he's supposed to do, and the world doesn't reward that. The world doesn't reward that. What use is it? He will go through, and our pilgrim will tell us what he reads, what he studies, okay? He is simple of speech. He is direct. Not a word spake he more than was nada, and that was side and forma and reverenza and short and quick and full of he sentenza. He moderates his speech. He is clear. He is concise. Meaning he has learned well. He has learned well. And there is obviously modesty in him. So ning in moral virtue was his specha, and gladly wold he lerna, and gladly techa. He has much to say, he understands much, and he will gladly keep learning, and he will gladly teach others. We have one of those pilgrims that is a model for us. But if you're going to be a model in that way, you're not going to be rewarded by the world. I'm skipping over the sergeant of the law. I'm skipping over the Franklin. I will come back to the Franklin because later we're going to look at the Franklin's tale. Notice then quickly, we get a haberdasher, a carpenter, a web, a dyer, a tapster, a cook, a shipman. They're all there. They're all going along. A doctor of physic we encounter. And then kaboom, there she is, the wife of Bath. Okay? And much as I would love to look at it now, I'll save it till we get to her prologue and tale. The lady is one of Chaucer's extraordinary creations. She looms large in the prologue and certainly in the tales. And she is the eldest mother of a whole set of women out there now. You know them. But we'll save that. I'm putting that aside till we come to her. To her tala, if you will. Now, I'm going to read this in full. It's fairly long. Find where we are. Right after the wife of Bath comes the parson. It is the parson who will give the last tale, who will give the sermon. After all of those fairly higher up ecclesiastical types, the prioress and the monk and the friar, we now see a simple parson. This for Chaucer, is the model of what a good religious man should be. As the knight is the model of those who fight in the world, okay? So now the parson is the model of what a great churchman is. And for that reason, he is the one who will finally, by his words, lead them into Canterbury. Who will give them, if you will, a chance to be prepared before they end their pilgrimage. If you want to find it, let me read through it. It's magnificent. It's long. And it's long because, very clearly, Chaucer the pilgrim knows a great churchman when he sees him. Okay? If he can be taken in by some of the others and fooled by some of the others and not see aspects of the characters of some of the others, please notice, he gets the measure of the clerk from Oxford instantly. And he gets the measure of the parson instantly. Why? Because there is no disparity between external and internal. These are men who are so fully connected, okay? If you will, these are personalities that are so integral. What you see on the outside is the inside. And in reporting what he sees, he's going to the core of the men, and what he recognizes, I would add the connect as well. Same thing with the knight. He just knows them. These are good men, and he can tell. We're not dealing with anything hypocritical, anything external. We're dealing with good men. Okay, here we go. A good man was there of religion, and was a pauvre person of a tune. Poverty again. Please notice, like the clerk. What's one? It seems to be one of the indicators of decency. Many of these others aren't poor. But wretche he was of holy thought and work. Poor in wealth, rich in his thought and work. He was also a learned man, a clerk. And please notice the connection. Maybe we have a hope that that young clerk of Oxford one day will grow into a really good parson of a town. That Christus gospel truly wold a preacher, his parishions devoutly wold he teacher. He knew the gospel, he preached it truly, and he taught it devoutly to his parishioners. Benigne he was, and wonder diligent, and in adversity full patient, patient in adversity. And swech he was a praved oft decisus, for loath were him to curse and for his teethes, but rather wolde he even out of duta, unto his pauvre parishions a buta of his offering and ache of his substanza. He would not go pounding on doors saying, where's your tithe? Give me your 10%, I need it. He'd take what came in, and he wouldn't keep it. The little he got, he would give to those in his parish who were poor. He could in little thing have sufficiance. He would be happy with the little things he had in his life. Weed was his parishion, houses fair asunder, but he na left not for rain na thunder, in sickness nor in mischief to visita, the fairest in his parisha much and lita. Big parish, but it didn't matter the weather, how he felt, he was out there and visiting his parishioners. Upon his fate and in his hand a staff. Okay? Walking there. He doesn't even have the thin horse that the clerk does, okay? This noble example to his shape, he yaf, that first he rocked, and afterward he talked. First he lives his life the way he should, and then he teaches the others how to live. He teaches first by example, and then tells them what they need to know. Out of the gospel, hath a word is caught, and this figure he added ache thereto, that if gold rusta, what shall Aaron do? It's wonderful. Takes it out of scripture, and then adds to it the notion, if gold rusts, what can we expect of iron? If a parish priest corrupts, what can you expect of the laity? And therefore he is especially cautious, given his position, his obligation, that, you know, being gold, and obviously not in terms of a sense of self-importance, but in the sense of what his duty is to his parishioners, he makes sure he does what he is supposed to. For if a priest be fool on whom we trust, no wonder is a lewd man to rust. It's the pilgrim knows that. If the priests are behaving that way, what do you expect of the rest of us? Okay? And shame it is if a priest take cape, a shitten shepherd, and a cleaner shape. It's really bad if the shepherd is covered with doo-doo, and the sheep are cleaner than the shepherd. Okay? It's an image from nature. It's an image from nature, and it's a powerful one. Well ought a priest and sample for to give by his cleanness, who that his shape should live. The priest is an example to his flock. He set a not his benefice to hear and let his shape encumbered in the mirror and ran to London unto St. Paul's to second him a chantery for solace. It's not, okay. He didn't go running off looking for a better situation that would give him more money where he'd be more comfortable. Or with a brotherhead to bane withhold, but dwelt at home and kept a well his fold. It's just beautiful. Very simple. Very simple. Very direct. So that the wolf namade it not miscaria. He was a shepherd and not a mercenaria, okay? He's a shepherd. He's not a mercenary. He's not out there being religious for hire. Who's making me the best offer? Where can I get the best position? And though he holy were and virtuous, he was to sinful men not despotos, okay? Very good and holy man, but if a sinner came to it, wasn't, you get away from me, I'm good, you're foul. None of that, none of that. Now, of his specia dangerous nedigna, but in his teaching discreet and benigna. I love it. Kind, quiet, discreet, and simple in his teaching. To draw in folk to heaven by fairnessa, by God and sampla, this was his busyness. I love it. To draw in folk to heaven by fairnessa, by good ensemble, this was his busyness. But it were any person obstinate, whatso he were of high or low estate, him would he snibbin sharply for the novice. But if he met a hardened sinner, look out! Look out. Didn't matter if he was high or low. If he met someone of hard heart, look out. A better priest e trawa there nowhere known is. He waited after no pomp and reverenza, ne marked him a specied conscienza, but Christus lore and his apostles twelva he taughta, but first he followed it himself. Please notice again. This is just clear and direct. Even our rather doubtful, uninspired pilgrim can see that this guy is special. And having just met him and seeing how he deals with the others, he understands him instantly. Goodness is not complicated. Doing one's duty and doing it well is open and clear. A holy man is there for everyone to recognize instantly. This is not subtlety. This is not subtlety. I simply must pay a little compliment here. And I'm sure all of you can fill in names. If clearly we have corrupt clergy now as there was corrupt clergy back then, at the same time, the parsons are still out there in the world doing their work. And God be praised for the last 18 years I've been privileged to go to Father Ringrose's parish in Vienna, Virginia. And I don't know if any of you know Father, but every time I read this description of the parson, I think of my own good parish priest and thank God for him. So this may have been written in, you know, just before the year 1400, but 600 years later, those good parish priests are still out there doing exactly the same thing. Doing exactly the same thing. And you better believe that when my time comes to end my pilgrimage and I'm at the gates of my final destination, I hope Father Ringrose is there to give me a good quick kick in the behind and anoint me as I make that crossing over. And it's no accident that this is the man who says the final words to the pilgrims as they arrive in Canterbury, and that our poet pilgrim then reacts the way he does at the very end, his last words. Makes perfect sense. The ending's already been being set up here, which means, again, we have an unfinished work, but we have a whole work in that we have the beginning, we have the end, and there is logic, sense, and order to it. Now, again, let's quickly run through some of the rest here. There's a reeve, a miller, a sumner, a pardoner, and a manciple, and myself. There were no more, he says. The miller will meet tomorrow morning. And once again, we get a sense from the description of the man in the prologue. The tale comes as no surprise. We should have expected it, okay? The others, the manciple, the reeve, I'm not going to go into the reeve's tale. I'll mention it very quickly tomorrow. Let's just say the reeve is more degenerate than the miller. Hard to believe, but he's a step down from the miller. The sumner is frightening figure. He worked for the ecclesiastical courts, and he would go out And quite literally, his job was to summon people to come to those courts. And this is, again, a man who is totally corrupt. Just give you a little touch of this. Contrast it with the parson. A summoner that was there with us in that plaza that had a fierce red cherubin's face. He seems to have a cherubin's face, but it's fiery red. For a sauce of flame he was with Ian Nerwa. he was terribly pimpled with narrow eyes. As hot he was and lecherous as a sparrow. The friar could fool the pilgrim. This guy doesn't fool the pilgrim. He sees him and he knows he's a lecher, not to be trusted. With scarlet brew is blacker and peeled beard. Of his visage a children were affaired. The children see his face and they run from him. There nas quicksilver litargan a brimstone, Boris serus na oil of tartar non, na ointment that wolde cleanse and beta, that him micta help him of his welkas wheata, nor of the cannabis sitting on his chakas. There is nothing, there's no lotion or mineral or oil in the world that would clean up that face. And here we have a case of corruption inside that's so profound, it is exploded outside on the face with these big knobs and pimples and sores. Whoa, man. But please notice, open, obvious, and our pilgrim can pick this one up. This is a case, again, of inside and outside. What can we say about the summoner to his credit? At least he's an integral man as well. The inside and the outside are indeed one. They are linked together. Where loved he garlic, onions, and eklekas, and for to drink and strong ween, red as blood. Then wold he spake and cree as he were wode. Eats garlics, onions, leeks, drinks really thick red wine, and then he'd cry out as if he was a crazy man. Delightful company. My point once again, everybody's going along, okay? Everybody's heading down this road together. I'll stop there. We learn more about him. But below him is the pardoner. Chaucer's creation of the pardoner stands in a very special place in the small rogues gallery of literature. Among those truly profound evil souls who are so evil and mysterious because they delight in their evil, which seems to exist without cause, they scare the living daylights out of us. The pardoner has his place next to Iago and Madame Defarge and Melville's Claggart and Billy Budd. There aren't a lot of them. But these characters are horrifying. We will wait with the pardoner because we can't get the full depth of his evil until we come to his prologue and tale. But what we have with the pardoner is an extraordinary creation. The depths to which corruption in the church can descend. Okay? It is not accident. Well, I'll give you just a touch of it. Just a touch of it. With him, he's riding with the summoner. He's a good friend of the summoner's. Okay. With him there rode a gentle pardoner. Well, okay. Of Roncesvalles, his friend and his compere, that Strich was common from the court of Roma. He's just been in Rome. He's just come back. He's going on the pilgrimage. For lewd he song, cum hider love tome. He's singing love songs. This somner bar to him a stiff burdoon, was never trump of half so great a soon. The harmony, the burden underneath is being sung by the summoner. The pardoner sort of riding on top, melodically, and the summoner is underneath him. This pardoner had a hair as yellow as wax, but smoe that hang as doth a streak of flax, long, stringy, greasy, yellow hair. Beunces hang his lockers that he had, and therewith hay his shoulders overspread, and long, this long, greasy, stringy, yellow hair hangs down over his shoulders. Again, our pilgrim is telling us something about this man. I use the term advisedly. But thin it lay, by corpus on and on. It's so thin, it's just hanging there strand by strand. But hard for Jarate wearied he non. He won't even cover up this ugly sight. For it was trussed up in his wallet. Him thought he rode all of the newer jet. De Chevalier save his copper, he rode all bare. Switch a glaring Ian had a hay as an hera. A vernacle had he sewed upon his copper, his wallet before him in his lapper, breath full of pardoon, coming from Roma, all hot. I'll just stop there. It's just, you get a sense of it. Slimy and disgusting, of questionable character, but he's got that hot wallet just full of pardons to sell to the unsuspecting, ignorant, faithful. Okay, and he's the last of them. Knew that I told you softly in a clause of the estate, the array, the number, and ache the cause. Okay. That's our group. That's our group. So now what we get for the rest of the prologue, and I've already gone through this, so I'll just run over it. We set up the terms of a little contest. It's going to take some time to travel to Canterbury. We're going from London. We're going by horse. Some are walking, okay? It's going to take some time. And in order to pass the time on the way, we'll tell each other stories. Now, I don't have a lot of time for this, but I'll just make the point. What we have here is indeed the sense of one reason for the purpose of art. And it's absolutely fair. We're all here in the world together. We're passing through the world together. And one thing we do is tell each other stories to pass the time. And there's a special joy in getting together and sharing good tales. For Chaucer in the Canterbury Tales, the point of that tale-telling is to occupy us as we move from point A to point B, to pass the time. I find it fascinating that in Shakespeare's late romances, those magnificent last plays that come at the end of his career that are so filled with accidents and losses and separations and reunions, when all the characters come back together again and there is almost this glorious vision of a reunion beyond the here and now, one thing they will spend their time doing is telling each other the stories of how they got there. You made it here. We survived. We're back together again. It's glorious. How did we get here? Well, let me tell you my story of how I wound up here. So there is the sense, if you will, that stories pass the time in this world. And that maybe if we're lucky enough to make it to that holy city, to the cathedral, we'll then spend time trying to figure out how we all got there. If all roads lead to Rome, Rome, in terms of the eternal city, the holy city, the heavenly city, in the counterpart, if you will, to the heavenly Jerusalem, there can be a lot of different paths that were traveled. There will be a lot of surprises as to how each individual wound up there, if we get there. Here, it's occupying the time as we get there, and let me say this, a story for Chaucer has two reasons for existing, okay? It's very clear. In medieval understanding, it has sense and sentenza. Sense, S-E-N-S. That is simply the entertainment value of the story. Tell me a good story. Tell me something that will entertain me and keep me occupied. Tell me a story that will delight and surprise me. I've got time to pass. We're riding down the road. Okay? Tell me an interesting story. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's what I call the entertainment factor in art. One part of art is sheer joy and entertainment and delight, and there's nothing wrong with that. Underneath it, however, is sentenza, just a sentence, as we would spell it, sentenza, but that is the kernel of meaning. Underneath, if you will, the exterior of the story, there is a kernel of meaning that is to be extracted, that is to be pulled out. And it is not necessarily, okay, always a pious message. One can learn from a contrary. In order to understand some of the stories in the Canterbury Tales that are shocking, you have to understand two things. One, they're matched to the teller. I'll emphasize this again tomorrow morning. If the miller were to tell the story of Saint Cecilia, it would make no sense. It makes perfect sense for the second nun to tell the story of Saint Cecilia. And the second nun does it beautifully, and it's appropriate. If the miller did it, it wouldn't make any sense. If the second nun told the miller's tale, woof, we'd have a severe problem. But what we are doing is getting the tale matched to the teller, and the tale, the individual story told by the individual soul, gives us the insight we need to what's happening inside. If the general prologue is an external snapshot, the tale you tell, the story you live by, when being told, tell me a story, what comes out of your mouth will make clear what's going on in your mind and your heart and your soul. So the tales reveal the teller. And there are some of the tales here that have been controversial for centuries, people trying to figure them out, I think because they've ignored some clear signs in terms of who the tellers are. It's the reason I want to spend some time on the Franklin's tale, a wonderful, mysterious story that tells us a whole lot about the Franklin and fits into the design in a brilliant way, and is often misread. So we'll take a look at that later. My point being, these stories are the teller. The story you are telling. When you go out in the world and you tell what you think, what the story is you live by, we find out who you are. In the same way, it's very clear when our Lord spoke in parables, those parables reveal who he was. Because they are filled with divine wisdom. They're filled with divine wisdom. The divinity of our Lord is in those parables. Now, what we get here, of course, is not just this vast range of tales that get told. The vast range of tellers. Chaucer, the poet, is showing off in some regard by saying, look, watch me. I can give you a good example of every kind of popular story from my time. And as a result, don't worry about these right now, we're going to get a chivalric romance, we're going to get a courtly lay, we're going to get a fablio, we're going to get a saint's life, we're going to get folktale, we're going to get beast tales, we're going to get a sermon at the end. And he does them all masterfully. It's showing off a bit. It's okay. Nobody else could do it. And what he does is everyone is perfect and everyone is connected with the teller. Okay? And we get the range of art from the period as well, the range of types of people who told such stories, and this seems very strange to us, but this is thoroughly medieval. All of these stories would have been known by the other listeners. Huh? Yep. The ideal was not, tell me something new I haven't heard before. Uh-uh. If one of these pilgrims had started out and said, okay, now I'm going to tell you a story that's completely new, you've never heard it before, all new characters, all new plot, the other pilgrims would have looked at him and said, surely we haven't sunk to that level, have we? The old stories are the best stories. No, tell us something we know, but show what you can do with it, okay? Show us, give us your version of a story. Oh yeah, we've heard that one before. Oh, but look what he does there. Oh, it's going that way. Oh, wait, we suddenly stop and we get, you're going to find this when I talk this afternoon about the Knight's Tale. Just all of a sudden the story is going to stop and the Knight's going to embellish. It's just going to go on at length. And we would think, man, why doesn't he get back to the action? And the medieval listener would say, wow, look what he's adding. Boy, that's good. Boy, I've never heard it told that way before. Is there more? Oh, yeah, he's going on with it. Whoa, boy, is he creative. It is an entirely different frame of mind and point of view. We are slaves of the new. We are slaves of originality. Can we be surprised we spit on tradition? What the Canterbury Tales tell us in the very fact of the choice of material for the tales is that you look backward. Because what came before you was better than anything you could possibly come up with. Now you can play with it, show what you can do with it, make it your own. But originality, creativity, please, please. Surely we've not descended to that. How dull. And in that very attitude, we have something thoroughly Catholic. You want to learn, you want to know, you want a rich repository of the best of thought and tale, then you look back. Because those who came before you knew better, did better, and you can try to rise to their level, but first and foremost, you honor them by carrying on the stories they told. And in telling them anew, you will pass them on. And that's Catholic.